From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Susan Davis in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. At least 50 people are dead after a tractor trailer carrying migrants was found abandoned in sweltering heat on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas, yesterday. At least 46 were found dead when officials first arrived at the truck, and more than a dozen, including children, were pulled from the trailer and taken to local hospitals for treatment. Joining us now is Texas Public Radio, Joey Palacios. Hey, Joey.
Hi, Susan.
So San Antonio Police Chief William McManus spoke last night. He said that a worker in one of the buildings nearby had heard a cry for help. They came to investigate, found a trailer with the doors partially opened, and took a look inside and found a number of deceased individuals. Can you tell us more about where this truck was left and what the conditions were like inside?
So outside of just on the border of San Antonio, this truck was found on Quintana Road on the southwest side, and it's a somewhat desolate area. There's a lot of trucks that go by. There's a few gas stations, and this road is alongside a very active freight train railroad. Last night, around 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock or so, McManus had said that this worker found this truck. He heard cries for help. With a short time after that, there were police vehicles, SAPD, San Antonio Fire Department as well, responding to what they would discover was initially 46 bodies. Mm. As you mentioned, that's now up to 50 people, and we're just now learning the nationalities of some of the folks that were inside of that trailer.
And what about that? Where are these people from?
So far from what Mexico's foreign ministry has said is that 22 people are from Mexico, 7 are from Guatemala, and 2 are from Honduras. The other 19, their identities and nationalities are unknown. And this is all information that's come out within the last few hours, as I mentioned, from Mexico's foreign ministry.
San Antonio is about 150 miles from the border with Mexico. Tell us more about the migrant traffic that moves through the region.
So, as you mentioned, it's about a 3-hour drive from Laredo, which is one of the busiest ports of entry for the United States. Interstate 35, which goes from Laredo all the way up to the border with Canada, is a route that is used for human smuggling quite frequently. And San Antonio is a nexus point for this because we also have Interstate 10, which goes from Los Angeles all the way to Jacksonville, Florida. Mm. So one of the reasons we see so many human smuggling operations come through here is because once you get to San Antonio, there you can pretty much hit up any other part of the country within a matter of hours or within a couple of days. And so we see frequently these types of incidences where people are found in these trailers. And we've had a previous incident where 10 people were killed in 2017.
Mm. What's been the reaction this time to this terrible discovery?
It's been pretty shocking. Elected officials here came out along with some of the law enforcement and first responders. San Antonio's mayor Ron Nirenberg was asking people to consider the human toll that this has brought. And there last night when I was out there, there were groups of people that were out to just see what was happening. I think at least maybe 30 or 40, after seeing the initial news reports, had begun driving or walking over to Quintana Road just to observe. There was one gentleman that I had spoken to that had just driven by that same area within the 3 hours before the trailer was discovered, and he said he didn't even see a trailer. He had said that the road was pretty much vacant as it usually is, and saw the incident on the news.
We should note that there are 3 people in custody. Briefly, the investigation has been taken over by the Homeland Security Department. What are they looking to answer here?
So a lot of the questions that we still don't know, for instance, as you mentioned, three people are in custody. We don't know what role they played. We don't know if one was a driver. We don't know why they were taken into custody. We also are still waiting on the identities of the people that were found and the 14 people that, I'm sorry, 12 people that still remain in the hospital. 16 were taken to the hospital last night.
Thank you. Joey Palacios is a reporter with Texas Public Radio. Joey, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Susan.
The U.S. House Committee investigating last year's January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol could get a glimpse inside former President Donald Trump's inner circle later today. The addition of a hearing today came as a surprise. It will include testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson, an aide to Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows. NPR's Ron Elving is here to help us understand what it means. Hey, Ron, great to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
So tell us about Cassidy Hutchinson. We know that she's already testified before the committee behind closed doors. What do we know about that testimony and why the panel would want to hear from her today?
Some of the testimony that she gave back in April has been used to be part of court documents that were used when Mark Meadows, her former boss, the former White House chief of staff, was resisting efforts to have him testify in person before this committee. And ultimately, he seems to have been able to resist, and an attempt to have him prosecuted for contempt of Congress has not been followed through on by the Department of Justice at this point. She was an aide to Mark Meadows. He brought her over from his congressional office when he made that move in 2020. He was the last chief of staff out of four for President Trump. And he came in sort of in war mode in the election year with the COVID virus raging. And he brought along trusted staffers, among them Cassidy Hutchinson, who had only been with him for a relatively brief period of time, but who had become an aide who came to every meeting, as other congressional staffers describe her.
Right, right. So we've been hearing for weeks now from this panel about the extent of Trump's plan and effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. We've heard that today the panel will present recently obtained evidence. What kind of evidence do you suppose this is, and how it might fit in with a case that the committee is making?
That reference to recent evidence, I think, got a lot of people off on what appears to have been a wrong direction, thinking that it had something to do with this BBC filmmaker who had spent extensive time with the Trump family in the fall of 2020 and leading up to January 6th, and has a lot of tape, some of which has been aired and some of which has not. But that does not appear to be the focus today. The focus seems to be going back to those days before January 6th in the White House itself, and what Mark Meadows was learning and what his aides knew at the time he knew. So the newness here may be more names of people who sought pardons through Mark Meadows, who asked for the president to pardon them for their part in what happened on January 6th.
I see. So it feels like there's a lot of theatrics around this. I mean, this hearing was shrouded in secrecy. It wasn't put on the schedule until yesterday. Is this just theatrics, or do you expect something big to come out of this?
There have been reports that Cassidy Hutchinson, this is a relatively young person who has only recently graduated from college and has been working on the Hill as an intern for a couple of other members of Congress. Then she had a White House internship, quite a prestigious distinction, and went back, finished college, came back to the Hill, worked for Mark Meadows, and when he moved, she moved. Now, Mark Meadows, we should add, was the co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus. This is the group that drove out two Republican speakers because they were so obstreperous and so hardline. So there's a lot of, shall we say, political energy around Mark Meadows, even before he went to the White House to serve as the president's last chief of staff. So the fact that he brought this particular staffer with him from the Hill, even though she had been with him only briefly, I think tells us something about the level of trust that she had and at least we are told by people who were in a position to know on the Hill, that he relied on her a great deal and brought her even to very small meetings. So what one would surmise from that would be that she sat in on some meetings that Meadows might have had with other members of Congress, or possibly even with the president himself, and may have heard what Trump heard about violence on January 6th, prior to January 6th, and whether or not the president had a reaction to that. There were hints of that in some of her earlier taped testimony. We've only seen a few minutes of that, but it went on for more than 20 hours. That's how much taped testimony they already have from Cassidy Hutchinson.
Right.
And she is going to share more of it with us at 1 o'clock today.
And Ron, when you mentioned violence, you're talking about the threat of violence prior to January 6th, that she might be able to shed light on what Mark Meadows knew about that, for example.
She has already said that the Secret Service had told Mark Meadows that there was going to be, or that there were at least groups that were planning to be violent on January 6th, and that he would have passed that information along to the president. We may hear more about that at 1 o'clock today.
All right. Well, that's NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving in Washington. Ron, thanks so much.
At least 18 people are reported killed and dozens more wounded after missiles destroyed a shopping center in Ukraine. The international community has condemned the Russian attack on the civilian gathering place. A United Nations spokesperson called the strike on civilians utterly deplorable. Leaders of the G7 nations meeting in Germany issued a statement saying attacks on innocent civilians constitute a war crime. NPR's international correspondent Emily Fang is in Kyiv and has been watching these events unfold. She joins us now. Welcome, Emily.
Hey, Sue. Thanks for having me.
So what is the latest about this missile strike on the shopping mall? We understand rescue efforts are still underway there.
Right. Now the death toll is up to 20 people. There are still about 36 people who are missing and about 48 people who are severely injured. So people are still closely watching this, and this has been a pretty bloody week in Ukraine. You've seen an escalated number of Russian missiles that have hit cities pretty much all across the country, even cities like Kyiv, where I'm now, that had been relatively shielded from most of the fighting since the end of March. And it's reminded people that they're living through a really bloody, violent war in their own country still.
Could you give us a sense of where the shopping center is located? Is it far from where the front lines of fighting is taking place?
Yes, this really surprised people. It's about 250 miles away from the front lines. It's in the middle of Ukraine. The missiles hit in an oblast or region in Ukraine called Poltava. It's been relatively untouched during this entire war because it's really not next to any major cities. It's not next to any major military installations. It appears to have no strategic value whatsoever. And so people are shocked and appalled that Russia would aim at what seems to be a civilian site in the late afternoon when more than 1,000 people were doing their daily shopping. Russia says it was aiming for a military site. It claims that across the street there was some kind of munitions factory. If you go to the Ukrainians, they say it was a factory making road pavement vehicles, you know, churning out asphalt. Either way, even if they were aiming for a military site, the Russians clearly hit wide of the mark and hit a shopping mall instead.
How has Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky responded to this?
He is understandably very agitated. He released video comments last night, Ukrainian time, a few hours after the attack, in which he called Russia the world's largest terrorism organization. And he urged other countries to recognize Russia as such. The U.S. Senate does have a resolution in committee recognizing Russia as a terrorist organization, but it has not been adopted yet.
The U.N. has already condemned the attack. Do you expect any further response from the international community?
I expect that this might give Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, some more backup when he continues to ask for heavier, more advanced anti-missile and anti-aircraft defense systems. Already, Ukraine is starting to deploy what's called HIMARS, so these incredibly advanced rocket launch systems that can hit targets 40 to 50 miles away. And the reason why Zelensky wants more weapons like these is because he expects Russia to be launching more aircraft, not just from Russia, but from Belarus, and hitting Ukrainian cities with cruise missiles. These have been incredibly violent attacks. They demoralize people. Certainly, they scare people. But also, I will say that people in Ukraine have learned to live with the fear of constant airstrikes. There are air raid sirens that go off all the time, like every half hour in Kyiv and many other cities. Most people just live with that danger, and they do not seek shelter when they hear those.
There were other Russian airstrikes over the weekend. One of them hit a kindergartner. What is your sense from your reporting of the mood of the Ukrainian people and as you've been out and about talking with them?
Right. There was a strike this past Sunday that hit a kindergarten. And because it was a Sunday, luckily there were no students or teachers there, but one man who was living in an apartment complex nearby did die. But it's really shocked people. Again, Kyiv had been relatively quiet. The last deadly attack in the capital had been about 2 months ago. Actually, the Russians hit the very same apartment complex 2 months ago. So people had sort of thought that Kyiv was far away from the fighting, which is concentrated to the east and the south of Ukraine. But again, Russians have reminded Ukraine that they could hit any city, anytime, anywhere.
That's NPR international correspondent Emily Fang reporting from Kyiv. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sue.
On Friday, a law takes effect in Florida banning most abortions after 15 weeks. And it's being challenged on religious grounds. A Jewish synagogue in Palm Beach County says the law violates the right to freedom of religion and privacy enshrined in Florida's Constitution. Barry Silver is the rabbi of Congregation Lador Vador, which filed the challenge. He's also a former Democratic member of the Florida House of Representatives. And welcome, Rabbi Silver. Good to have you.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Rabbi Silver, in what way does Florida's new abortion law violate the freedom of religion?
This law would actually criminalize the practice of Judaism, because in the law, they've written into the law the concept that fundamentalist Christians have about when life begins and when abortion is permitted. Judaism is totally different. The fundamentalist Christian says life begins at conception, according to the Bible, which is a misconception. The other thing is that they say that abortion can only be done under extreme circumstances, whereas in Judaism, abortion is freely available to the woman. Certainly, we respect potential life, but the woman has an absolute right up until the time of birth in order to have an abortion, if necessary, to protect her emotional well-being or her physical health. And if she were to do that and exercise that right, she would be could be criminally prosecuted.
So, Rabbi Silver, fair to say that you have a liberal view of Judaism, because there are other leaders in the Jewish faith who don't agree with this interpretation. I'm looking at Rabbi Moshe Hauer, executive vice president of the Orthodox Union. He told the New York Times that abortion is necessary if a mother faces grave physical or psychological harm, but is not permitted because of simple difficulty or a belief in the right to choose. So is it fair to say there's disagreement within your faith about what restrictions should exist?
They say the only thing two Jews can agree on is how much a third should give to charity. However, this Orthodox rabbi is not quoting Jewish law, even Orthodox Judaism. He doesn't understand the Orthodox position, and you notice he doesn't cite any authorities. My position is the traditional view. You are correct that I am a modern Jew. I don't believe the Torah was written by God. I don't believe it's infallible or inerrant. And so I look at it as guidance, and there's certain parts of it that are rather primitive and barbaric. But if I was an Orthodox rabbi, and I was going according to the Torah, I would not say what this Orthodox rabbi is saying. What he is saying is not based on orthodoxy. It's based on the fact that the Orthodox Jews are now in bed with the fundamentalist Christians because they support Israel. According to Orthodox Judaism, according to the Torah, life begins at birth. It says in Genesis that God breathed life into the humans after they were already formed, and they lived. It says in Ezekiel that God breathed life into the dry bones. There's many passages that say in Maimonides, who's the icon of Orthodoxy, in the Talmud says, "Ubar yelachimo," the fetus is part of the mother. And it also says that in Orthodox Judaism, the mother has the absolute right to do away with the fetus if necessary to protect her emotional well-being. What he's saying is nonsense. I'll debate him, and I ask him to cite authorities. It is true that Judaism has respect for life and respect for potential life, and we don't necessarily approve of just willy-nilly having an abortion. But what he's saying is that it's only under extreme circumstances. It's rubbish.
All right.
It's not based on Jewish law.
So let me ask you this. Florida's law does make some exceptions after 15 weeks for cases where a mother's life is endangered or if a fetus has a fatal abnormality. Do you believe Judaism allows for any restrictions on abortion?
There are no restrictions on abortion, according to Judaism, that should be legislated. Judaism believes that it's up to the mother. Now, if the mother decides that she wants to have an abortion for reasons that other rabbis would disagree with, that's her right. They might say, well, you know, we don't really think that you lived up to the principles, but it's not murder. It's within her discretion. It's kind of like if somebody decides if they're going to keep kosher or not. They could, they might not. But it's nobody has the right to tell them what to do.
So make the link to Florida's Constitution in terms of what rights are enshrined in Florida's Constitution that you're referring to specifically in this case.
Well, by the way, we filed a lawsuit based on Florida's Constitution, which parallels and tracks the language of the federal Constitution. So this lawsuit that we filed can be done in every single state in the country because it's based on the First Amendment to the United States and also the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically what it says is that government cannot allow the establishment of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. What we're saying is that the fundamentalist Christians have established their view of when life begins, their view of when abortion is permissible on everybody else. And it also violates the other side of it, that it prohibits the free exercise of Judaism, because right now it's a criminal offense to practice Judaism when it comes to abortion. Mm.
So you've made the text of your lawsuit available online. You're hoping other synagogues across the country file similar lawsuits. What are you hearing? Have others followed your example?
Yes. Well, one of the reasons why I did that is because I've been receiving phone calls and emails from all over the country saying, Ra, we support you. We think it's great. We want to do the same thing too. And we want to help you. And I always say, well, thank you for the help. That's awesome. But you can do the same thing. And I suggest that if it's filed like that all over the country, good things are going to happen. And maybe it'll make mine better. I spent a lot of time based on being a rabbi, an attorney, and a former legislator to come up with the best lawsuit I could. And I think it's pretty good, but other people can take it and run with it and make it better and apply it to their case.
All right. Well, that's Rabbi Barry Silver of Congregation Lador Vador in Palm Beach County, Florida, which is challenging new abortion restrictions in Florida on religious grounds. Rabbi, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Any good financial planner will tell you how important it is to have emergency savings. In fact, if you were listening to our show yesterday, you heard CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger remind us about that very thing.
Every single one of us who went through the pandemic, and we all did, now knows the value of an adequate emergency reserve fund. And what is adequate? It is 6 to 12 months of your living expenses in a boring old savings, checking, money market, or short-term CD.
Good advice, sure, but emergency savings might not be an option for people struggling to make ends meet. In fact, more than half of the population is living paycheck to paycheck and particularly vulnerable to the effects of record high inflation and a potential recession. That's according to a new report by the company Lending Club. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, is with us now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So too many Americans have been living paycheck to paycheck for a long time. This report shows a small but notable 4% increase from the same time last year. So how vulnerable is this group at this current moment?
It's striking in that we were, you know, before we were talking so much about pressing inflation, you have this great problem to have with the economy is a lot of people are just checking out of the workforce and unemployment was maybe dangerously low. And you're thinking that people don't need these jobs and maybe aren't paycheck to paycheck and that they're seeing their wages rise for the first time. But this is a clap back to reality. And moreover, you're finding that not only the most vulnerable Americans, but even nearly a third of those earning $250,000 or more are living paycheck to paycheck and can't deal with an emergency expense. And so I think across the board, we're kind of overextended beyond our means.
Really interesting. So during the early months of the pandemic, we heard that lots of people were able to save money. They were helped by the stimulus check, among other things. What does the savings picture look like now? It doesn't sound like it's very good based on what you just said.
Yeah, what happens with savings and that money, if it is being saved and earning nothing in a zero interest savings account, we've talked about that repeatedly, how savers have been hit in this environment, it absolutely gets corroded by 9% inflation. You might think about it as theoretical, but when you increasingly have to tap into savings to make ends meet for the gas bill, for the grocery bill, for rent hikes, you realize how pernicious inflation really is.
Right. Now, we currently have pretty low unemployment. So is that a bright spot for people whose finances are tight right now? It sounds like a lot of them are working.
Well, wages are still rising at a slower pace than inflation. So you kind of have to temper your enthusiasm. It's very hard to extend your paycheck to cover everything. But the good news is if you are looking to work and work more, there are plenty of openings, plenty of hours available. But we do know with the pandemic, and I'm sure as Jill has noted previously, there are other assorted expenses for healthcare and for transportation. And the more you want to work, the more your variable costs rise, daycare costs rise, clothing costs. There has been a lot saved by this work from home reality, but a cold reality when inflation and hybrid work return.
Right. What about debt? Credit card debt, other kinds of debt. How much of a debt burden is there for people who don't have a lot of income coming in?
Yeah, we have to shed extra tears for them because they have to increasingly rely on credit cards to make ends meet, to extend themselves, to extend the paycheck, and kind of buy themselves a bridge loan. And these rates are going to go up as interest rates go up.
All right. Well, that's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, always a pleasure. Many thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yesterday, we heard from a county prosecutor in Missouri who told us how uncomfortable she will be enforcing her state's near total ban on abortion. Missouri's new law doesn't make exceptions for cases of rape and incest, and prosecutor Jean Peters-Baker said it will force rape and incest survivors to give birth to their abusers' children.
To look at these victims and to know that the law may victimize them again. It's unconscionable, and I cannot come up with a better word than mean.
Well, let's hear a different perspective on this. Missouri State Representative Mary Elizabeth Coleman, a Republican, is a supporter of the state's new law banning all abortions except for medical emergencies, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program, Representative Coleman. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you heard Prosecutor Jean Peters-Baker there, who says an anti-abortion law that doesn't provide for exceptions for rape or incest is mean. How do you respond to that?
So rape is one of the most violent crimes that we deal with in any state, and it is one of the most intimate kinds of violence experienced by any person. And so it's so important that we listen to the voices of the women who have conceived in rape and their adult children who were themselves conceived in rape. So, you know, I hear from friends like Rebecca Kistler, who founded an organization called The One, and it's made up entirely of women who conceived in rape, as well as the adult children who were conceived out of that violent act. And you know, what Rebecca stresses is that her life has value just as much as your life or my life does, and that we don't punish anyone else for their father's crime. And in this instance, we shouldn't as well.
The law would prosecute anyone who performs an abortion, but the prosecutor we spoke to yesterday, Jean Peters-Baker, she's concerned that the law is worded in such a way that women seeking to terminate their own pregnancies could also be prosecuted. Is that how you interpret the law, and is that the intent of the law?
So as one of the architects of the bill in question, as well as a practicing attorney who works in this area, if you were to have asked Jean to point to the language that she was concerned about, she couldn't do it because under Chapter 188, where this section of the code resides in the state of Missouri, it's abundantly clear that both under the definition of an abortion, as well as the plain reading of the exception, that it is clear no woman will ever be prosecuted for obtaining an abortion in the state of Missouri.
So Jean Peters-Baker did point to the language that she was concerned about. She said that the language says, and you know it better than me, that a woman couldn't be prosecuted for conspiracy. She said if that phrase ended after the word couldn't be prosecuted, period, she'd be more comfortable with it.
So Jean should know better. That is one specific section of that code that is making it clear that in case there was some overzealous prosecutor who was overreaching, that not only could she not be charged with obtaining an abortion, but she also couldn't be charged with conspiracy for working with somebody else to receive that abortion. Mm. It's really important, as we're all getting better at talking about abortion, that we're all working with facts and that we're not working with scare tactics.
Well, let me ask you about another fact that Prosecutor Peter Spaker brought up yesterday. She told us that she didn't know if it would be illegal under state law for a woman in Missouri to consult with a doctor out of state about terminating a pregnancy and obtaining abortion-inducing pills out of state. What's your view on that? What would the Missouri law say about that?
Sure. So again, she is mistaken in this regard. So the abortion pill is now contraband and illegal in the state of Missouri. A woman could have a telehealth appointment with a physician out of state if that physician is located out of state, but she wouldn't be able to receive the abortion pill via the mail or any pharmacy in the state of Missouri. That provider would be breaking the law in Missouri by mailing it to her.
I see. Those pills would come through the mail. And isn't the mail system regulated federally? And wouldn't this be a case of federal law stumping state laws? What's your interpretation of that?
Yeah, so state law is going to guide what is legal and illegal in the state of Missouri in the same way that different states have rules on what fireworks can be sent through the mail. So it's true that we have a federal mail system and that there is federal preemption to laws. But where states have laws on areas that the federal government has deferred to the states, or there is no federal law on, like abortion, then those state laws are going to be guiding. I'll also say, as we're kind of looking at what's happening nationally, my priority and my focus right now is making sure that we are able to get a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot to make it clear that our state's constitution has nothing to say about abortion in the same way our federal constitution has nothing to say about abortion.
Representative Coleman, I want to come back to a concern from Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker that she raised yesterday. Her biggest point is that because this is such a complex issue, so personal, so multifaceted, that she just didn't believe that a county prosecutor belonged in the middle of it. What do you say to her? I mean, I know that you come from a different side of the political balance sheet, so to speak.
This is not a political issue. The right to human dignity and
it's a political issue, and that politicians are passing laws about it. So that's what I'm asking you about.
But it's just not necessarily partisan. There are pro-life Democrats, and there have been, in fact, in Missouri, a long history of being a pro-life state under both parties.
But if you'll permit me, I just wanted you to respond to her concern as someone who is trying to do her job as a county prosecutor and having real concerns about putting herself in the middle of a very complex and personal and painful human moment.
Well, unfortunately, the work of a prosecutor is inserting themselves in incredibly difficult circumstances. There is no one who is there with victims of violent crime more than our county prosecutors. And if that's a role she's uncomfortable in, then she should perhaps find other employment. If she or other, prosecutors around the state choose not to enforce our laws against providers, then the Attorney General can and should step in to enforce the laws of the state of Missouri.
Mary Elizabeth Coleman, she's a Republican and a state representative from Missouri. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Anthony.
The Department of Education is settling a case that will grant almost $6 billion in debt relief to students. They allege that unscrupulous, mostly for-profit colleges deceive them into overpaying for often useless degrees. Many of these students were veterans swindled out of their GI Bill education and benefits, and now they're celebrating the decision. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Jared Toma served in the U.S. Army and then planned to become an engineer when he got out. But he says DeVry University, a for-profit school, drained his GI Bill benefits and encouraged him to take out tens of thousands more in loans. Then he graduated in 2015.
Well, what's the degree worth? It's not even worth the paper it's printed on. I've had an extremely hard time finding employment.
The Trump administration's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, repealed rules that required schools to prove their degrees led to gainful employment. And her department fought this class action lawsuit, which the Biden administration has now settled in U.S. District Court. Carrie Wofford is with Veterans Education Success.
This is a huge deal for many students who were tricked and deceived and cheated by really lousy, mostly for-profit colleges. This is not student debt cancellation for any student. This is only if you were cheated.
Also, schools have a limit on how much federal money they can take. But for years, there was a loophole. GI Bill money didn't count against that quota. That made veterans a highly profitable target, says Wofford.
It's veterans like Jared Toma, who were just totally targeted for their GI Bill and targeted in really ugly ways.
Now, Toma and his family are about $50,000 out of the red. He's been carrying that debt around for 7 years.
I was at a loss for words. I was in shock, disbelief, really ecstatic. I told my wife first thing. I'm still at a loss for words. I can't believe it's finally at some sort of resolution. And I feel vindicated.
The Department of Education says it will send billions of dollars of automatic relief to about 200,000 borrowers in the class action lawsuit. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
One of the year's hottest video games has also been called its most exploitative.
If humanity is to survive, they must stand together and face the rising darkness.
That's Diablo Immortal. Some players have dumped thousands of dollars into the game. Critics say it uses devilish psychological tricks to get people hooked and spending money. Others say the game is illegal. The business model got the game banned in Belgium and the Netherlands. For more, we're joined by Polygon Deputy Games Editor Maddie Myers. Hey, Maddie.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So Diablo Immortal made a reported $24 million in its first 2 weeks. The game doesn't technically cost anything to download. So how do you play it? And more importantly, how did it make all that money?
Well, I think people might be familiar with the idea of a free-to-play mobile game. Maybe they have Pokemon Go, for example, sure. Which is not decried as being quite as manipulative emotionally as Diablo Immortal. But folks are probably at least familiar with the concept. You download a game, you play it for a while. If you want to advance just a little bit faster, not have to collect all those items all by yourself, you can just throw a couple bucks at it and get those items right away. And that is more or less how Diablo Immortal works. It's just that it's significantly deeper. There are a lot of different kinds of characters you can choose. This is a medieval setting. You're clicking on little skeletons in order to destroy them. You're fighting the devil eventually, hence the title Diablo. And also the amount of things you can buy in the game is astounding. And the more you buy, the better you perform. That's the controversial part.
It sounds like it's just like gambling. I mean, gambling, you hit the jackpot. Here's what can happen when you beat a boss. You'd see this big golden chest burst open, showering you with valuable items and gold.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Isn't that a satisfying sound, too? They always put in that just sparkly sound effect to make you your dopamine really surge.
Right. And then your odds of getting great loot go up the more money you spend. So is this game really any different than playing a slot machine?
You know, I would say it's not. And even the original creators of Diablo, which started out as a PC game, have compared the game to a slot machine. Although it's worth noting that the original Diablo games didn't have the microtransactions aspect of it all. You paid one cost in order to download the game, and you'd still get randomly generated loot or weapons or items, I guess I should say. But when you add microtransactions to the equation, you get that slot machine effect in a much more literal way. That's the piece of it that I think may have upset some officials in the Netherlands and Belgium.
So let's get to that backlash. Diablo is very popular. Mm-hmm. Fans got used to buying each title once and that being basically the only transaction between the company and player. Many of them booed when Diablo Immortal was announced as a mobile game all the way back in 2018.
Do you guys not have phones?
Yeah, you guys all have phones, right?
But as we've seen, this mobile game model reaps huge profits. So are the gamers who really slam Diablo Immortal just living in the past?
Well, some of them might be, but I think the backlash comes in two different forms, actually. There is a gendered backlash against mobile gamers that is based on the fact that that's a very diverse gaming platform. Everybody does have a phone, after all. But then there's also a backlash against the kinds of predatory monetization techniques that are used in certain mobile games, free-to-play mobile games.
Yeah.
I would also say, for example, Pokemon Go, my go-to example, because it's so popular. No predatory microtransactions there, in my personal opinion. You can buy stuff if you want. It's also pretty fun to just play it without spending a dime. Diablo Immortal, however, I think the backlash, despite that some of it did seem gendered, at least at first, now that the game is actually out and we can see how it's been designed, we as critics and as gamers can tell that unfortunately it is using some of the worst predatory design practices that can be attached to microtransactions. But even the original Diablo games still had that emotional manipulation. Even though you were just paying once at the beginning and there wasn't a dollar sign attached to every treasure chest you opened, those games were still addictive. And I'm not sure if any game that's addictive can ever be fully value neutral. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the developer, though. Activision Blizzard, they're no stranger to controversy. The state of California has sued them over claims of sexual harassment.
Yeah.
How are they reacting to these criticisms?
You know, they seem just fine with it.
Yeah.
As of now, the game is at 10 million installs, and Blizzard did an official tweet from their account saying, in just 1 week, Diablo Immortal is the biggest launch in franchise history, suggesting by this tweet that this is a massive win for Diablo fans everywhere, which is funny because critically, this game has been panned by people. Yes, it's making a lot of money and a lot of people are installing it, but people who actually review video games for a living and also user reviews are decrying how manipulative the game actually feels to play. And it makes you wonder, are all those people spending money because they really want to or because they feel like they were tricked into it?
That's Polygon Deputy Games Editor Maddie Myers. Maddie, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Susan Davis in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston. It's Here and Now.